immediately appointed Patrick Fitzgerald, then serving as the United States Attorney in Chicago, as special counsel to oversee the investigation. Although Fitzgerald was a political appointee and a close friend of mine, he had a strong reputation for independence, and as the U.S. Attorney in Chicago, was far enough away not to be seen as part of the executive branch leadership. I went one step further. Because I was also a senior political appointee of President Bush, I delegated to Fitzgerald all my powers as acting attorney general. I remained his supervisor, but he didn't need to ask me for permission to take any step in the case, which emphasized the independence of the investigation. In December 2003, I held a press conference to announce the appointment. The Department of Justice routinely makes press announcements of significant developments in its work, including decisions to bring public charges or lawsuits or the resolution of those cases. In matters of significant public interest, the Department has long confirmed investigations and reported the completion of significant investigations without charges. Anytime a special prosecutor is named to look into the activities of a presidential administration, it is big news, and predictably my decision was not popular at the Bush White House. A week after the announcement, I substituted for the Attorney General at a cabinet meeting with the President. By tradition, the Secretaries of State and Defense sit flanking the President at the cabinet room table in the West Wing of the White House. The Secretary of the Treasury and the Attorney General sit across the table, flanking the Vice President. That meant that as the substitute for the Attorney General, I was at Vice President Dick Cheney's left shoulder. Me, the man who had just appointed a special prosecutor to investigate his friend and most senior and trusted advisor, Scooter Libby. As we waited for the President, I figured I should be polite. I turned to Cheney and said, "Mr. Vice President, I'm Jim Comey from Justice." Without turning his face to me, he said, "I know. I've seen you on TV." Cheney then locked his gaze ahead as if I weren't there. We waited in silence for the President. My view of the Brooklyn Bridge felt very far away. I had assured Fitzgerald at the outset that this was likely a 5 or 6 month assignment. There was some work to do, but it would be a piece of cake. He reminded me of that many times over the next 4 years, as he was savagely attacked by the Republicans and right-leaning media as some kind of maniacal Captain Ahab, pursuing a case that was a loser from the beginning. Fitzgerald had done exactly as I expected once he took over. He investigated to understand just who in the government had spoken with the press about the CIA employee and what they were thinking when they did so. After careful examination, he ended in a place that didn't surprise me on Armitage and Rove. But the Libby part, admittedly a major loose end when I gave him the case, turned out to be complicated. Libby not only lied about his interaction with Tim Russert, claiming that he'd heard the covert agent's name from him, but 8 Bush administration officials testified they talked to Libby about the covert agent's name. More evidence revealed that Libby had proactively discussed the CIA employee with reporters at the vice president's request to push back on stories critical of the administration's basis for invading Iraq. Why Libby, an attorney who graduated from Columbia Law School, lied is not clear. Maybe he didn't want to admit that the leak started at the vice president's office, which would have caused political embarrassment, or he didn't want to admit to an angry President Bush that he had been among the leakers. It took Fitzgerald 3 years of litigation to get to a place where he charged, tried, and convicted Libby of making false statements in a federal investigation, perjury, and obstruction of justice. Republican loyalists howled that he was persecuting Libby because prosecutors could never prove the underlying crime, the intentional leaking of a covert agent's name with prior knowledge of its illegality. Of course, these were the same Republicans who passionately believed that President Bill Clinton's lies under oath over an affair with an intern simply had to be pursued because obstruction of justice and perjury strike at the core of our system. Meanwhile, Democrats, who 6 years earlier attacked the case against Bill Clinton as a silly lie about sex, had discovered in the Libby case that they cared deeply about obstruction of justice crimes when the obstructors were Republicans. I would discover in the coming months that the pressures to bend the rules and to make convenient exceptions to laws when they got in the way of the president's agenda were tempting. And it was a temptation fed by the urgency of the topic and the nature of the people around the president, people who couldn't take the long view or understand the importance to the country of doing things the right way, no matter the inconvenience. They would be painful, exhausting lessons in the importance of institutional loyalty over expediency and politics, and more preparation for the future I couldn't yet see. Chapter 6. On the Tracks. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. Rudyard Kipling, If. It was after 7 p.m. on March 10, 2004. Another long, hard day as Acting Attorney General of the United States, a post I'd temporarily assumed on behalf of an ailing John Ashcroft that had put me in the center of an ugly battle with the Bush White House. It was about to get even uglier. My security team was driving me in an armored black Suburban, headed west on Constitution Avenue, past the museums, the Washington Monument, and the south lawn of the White House. Senior government officials are assigned protective details based on threat assessments. As the United States Attorney of Manhattan, I didn't have one. But since 9/11, the Deputy Attorney General was driven in an armored Suburban and shadowed by armed Deputy U.S. Marshals. At the end of a long day, I was tired and ready to get home. Then my cell phone rang. On the line was David Ayers, Attorney General John Ashcroft's Chief of Staff. Ayers was one of those rare people who seemed to grow calmer in the middle of a storm. And there was a metaphorical hurricane hitting, so his voice was stone cold. Ayers had just gotten off the phone with Janet Ashcroft, who had been keeping vigil at her husband's bedside at George Washington University Hospital. Attorney General Ashcroft had been hospitalized with acute pancreatitis, so severe that it had immobilized him with pain in the ICU. Minutes earlier, Ayers reported, the White House operator had attempted to put a call through to the ailing Attorney General from President Bush. I knew what this was about. So did Ayers. And so did the savvy Janet Ashcroft, who, like her husband, was a sharp and accomplished attorney. Janet Ashcroft had refused the call. Her husband was too sick, she said, to talk to the president. Undaunted, President Bush then told her he was sending his counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and his chief of staff, Andrew Card, to the hospital to discuss a vital matter of national security with her husband. She immediately alerted Ayers, who called me. After finishing the call, I spoke in an unusually sharp voice to the United States Marshal Service driver, Ed, I need to get to George Washington Hospital immediately. The urgency in my tone was all he needed to hit the emergency lights and begin driving as if the armored car had dropped onto a NASCAR track. From this moment forward, I was in a race, a literal race against two of the president's most senior officials in one of the wildest, most improbable moments in my entire career.